I wish that she could run up and hug me and not flinch. And I wish she could take her medicine without it being painful, because it is. It's incredibly painful every time she takes it.
What would you do if the medication that kept your daughter alive also caused her unbearable pain? 12-year-old Emmy Reeves, from Columbia, South Carolina, had type 1 diabetes, a condition shared by over 1 million Americans. It's usually treatable with insulin medication. But Emmy had an extremely rare problem, an allergy to insulin medication. The Reeves family eventually connected with Dr. Raja Kandaswamy, a transplant surgeon at the University of Minnesota Department of Surgery. Dr. Kandaswamy's proposal was to make Emmy the youngest pediatric pancreas transplant recipient in the United States in nearly 25 years. He spoke to me about Emmy's remarkable story and the development of pancreas transplantation that gave her hope. You are listening to Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories, a podcast about surgeon scientists, the things they care about,
and why it matters to you.
We're not superhuman.
You don't have time to specialize in both things at once.
The more I learned about it, the more I recognized that this needed to be brought to the forefront.
When you get a bad outcome, how do you manage your own emotions?
That feeling that you get when the patients say thank you, that's why I do it.
Join the conversation. This is Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories.
I have to take you back to when I first heard about Emmy's story. It was an email from Jack, the dad, who works at a university, writing to me about her story of how Emmy has been diabetic since early childhood and has severe intolerance to insulin. And they have sought help from multiple academic centers to try and get rid of this intolerance to no avail. And her own doctor said that you should reach out to Minnesota because they are the leaders in pancreas transplantation to see if she would be a candidate for this procedure. I get a lot of emails about queries that may be, you know, some off-the-cuff queries, some things that may be out there. But this query seemed especially genuine to me. And I decided to look into this further. I set up a phone call with Jack, and we talked about her condition from the beginning of life to where she was today. And it became clear to me this is a very unique case that we needed to explore further. So I said, let's bring her over here and see her. And she came here early summer of 2017, and we first time I saw Emmy, she was a 12-year-old. It was clear to me that she had been affected by these 8 years of being in horrible pain and having horrible side effects, being medicated in order to control the side effects. You could not touch her skin without her wincing. A part of that may have been true pain. Part of that is the hypersensitivity of having experienced so many episodes of pain that she didn't want to be touched.
And just probably general, just constant exposure to medical professionals.
As well. But we see other kids but who have chronic illnesses. This hyperesthesia, as we call it, which is sensitivity to touch, was profound. And she had a rash in many areas on her skin. She had received recent insulin that morning to control her sugars. She had another unique condition, which is rare in such a young age group, which is hypoglycemia unawareness, meaning Emmy could drop her sugar down to dangerously low levels, which is life-threatening, and not experience any symptoms. If your blood sugar or my blood sugar goes down to below 60, we start sweating. We start feeling a little palpitations. We start sensing it because the body has these defense mechanisms. But with that long-standing diabetes, you lose some of those sensitivities. And she could get down to the 40s or 30s and not sense it. And once you get down to those levels, it can cause low oxygen or low glucose supply to the brain. And the brain needs glucose. Therefore, you can imagine what that does to the brain when it's not receiving enough nutritional support during those phases. It can lead to loss of consciousness, and in some cases it can cause the demise of the patient. So she had that deadly condition in addition to the intolerance to the insulin. So it was a double whammy, so to speak, for her. And her personality was withdrawn at that time. You couldn't get her to engage as much as she is today, knowing what she can be. It struck me, it really struck a chord in me, and I decided to get a group of specialists together, because this would be a unique case if we transplanted her. As I said before, we haven't done a transplant for this particular condition ever, as far as I know, and the last pediatric transplants was over 2 decades ago in this institution. So we strode carefully, I would say. We had a team of nephrologists, endocrinologists, pain specialists, geneticists, and nurse clinicians and nurses, anesthesia, all of which got together. Everybody saw her. And what really struck me was everybody agreed with our plan. When you're looking at a rare case like this, there's bound to be a variety of opinions. There were flavors of opinions, but at the end of the day, everybody felt we should help her if we can.
This doesn't sound like a small team either.
No, it is not. And it was truly amazing that everybody came together and worked as a team in deciding to go ahead with listing her for transplant. So we listed her towards late summer last year, and Emmy and her mom decided to move here, because there was always this question that how would you travel from South Carolina to here when the offer came through? It may take you many hours, and that might rule you out for some organs. Just like it's a problem transporting organs, sometimes it's a problem transporting recipients. Here they decided to remove that variable by finding a place to stay here. Mom relocated with Emmy here and lived here for the next few months waiting for a pancreas transplant. Of course, that put a lot of pressure on us, because here we are trying to take organ offers when they come by and deciding on the right organ. We don't want to take anything that may be less than stellar for her. But on the same token, we realize with every passing week, they've put their life on hold and they're here living in another city all by themselves. We did turn down several offers for her. There was one dry run, I think from Oklahoma, where we were going to go get the organ. Everything looked okay, but the timing of it would not have worked out where she could have gotten it in time within the 8 to 12 hours I wanted to get the pancreas within. So there were a few, dry runs, misses, near misses. Finally, February 10th, we got an organ offer from nearby where our team could go out 45-minute to an hour drive and then look at the organ and let us know. So I called Emmy's mom. I think it was maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, and we went over this, and you could see the excitement in their voice because they had been waiting for this call for the last 8 months, and they could hardly believe it. So they came in, and we talked, and she has a great account of it from her side. I don't think I can put it as eloquently, the emotions she felt. And when I walked in and I told them the pancreas looks good, I got word from the donor team saying pancreas looks good. Now we can take Emmy into the operating room. You could just see the emotions play out in front of you. And then once we went into the operating room, we got into work mode. We did not get awed by the moment or the significance of this transplant. We went into autopilot and we did it just like we would do any transplant, which is probably the best mode to go into. And the transplant went well, exceedingly well.
How long does such an operation take?
About 4 to 5 hours to do the operation from beginning to finish. It takes us a couple of hours just to prepare the pancreas when it comes back to make it ready for transplantation. Simultaneously, they're putting the patient on anesthesia and getting things ready, so it's not just downtime. So a total of about 4.5 hours, I think, in her case. And we came out, and I told the family. I was on a conference call with Jack, the dad, who's with the younger daughter back home. So he was on the line, and I was talking to her mom, telling them the pancreas transplant went well. I got a big hug from mom, and I knew then we had done our job. Now it was the next part was to make sure that we maintained this pancreas because there were several challenges ahead of us. And we did face some challenges during the first 4 weeks. Her body attempted to reject the pancreas, but we picked it up really early, and we treated it, and she turned around, and she got out of the hospital. By the time she left the hospital, we were sending her home without any insulin shots, which was the goal of the transplant, which means she didn't need any of the side effect medications. She was going back to doing art, which she was really good at. She's a great artist. She brought some artwork yesterday to my clinic, and I could not believe it. In fact, I'd like to see if we can present some of that out in the media, because this is an amazing artist.
I wanted to ask you, how quickly after the transplant, did these types of quality of life changes begin to occur?
The first 4 weeks she spent in the hospital, quality of life was improved, but being in the hospital, you could not be very clear about what quality of life you had because you're in a hospital. So once she left the hospital, she started saying, I feel like a different person.
So things like the pain, the sensitivity, these things actually started to clear up very quickly.
They're gone at this point, and she's 3 months out now. But it went away, I would say, in the first 6 weeks. She's off of every side effect medication that she's been on before. She's on two medications to suppress her immune system. She's leading a normal life at this point and is just waiting to go back home. She's eating better. She's still remaining on a quote-unquote healthy diet with not excessive carbs, with just like anybody should. But she's not on a diabetic diet anymore. She can, if she wants to eat an ice cream, she can do that, which she could never do in the past. So there are some simple luxuries of life that she had never experienced before that she's able to enjoy now. And I can see it makes her a happy kid, and she's a different kid now.
How does it make you feel to be a part of this?
Very fulfilling, I think. This is a case not without its risks, because it's the first of its kind in a long time, and a lot of things could have gone wrong. It is certainly not, from a programmatic standpoint, may not have been the smartest idea to take a risk on something like this, but we all uniformly felt that this was the best solution for this particular child, and we were willing to take that risk. And when we did take that risk and she did well from it, that feeling is irreplaceable. And because if we were all prepared, parents were prepared, we were prepared for things to go wrong, which can happen. But we are very fortunate that things went well, and we learned a lot of lessons from this that will help us in shaping decisions like this in the future. The one thing I learned from it was, and I heard this from my mentor, do what you would do for your child, your mother, or your sister, not what you would do for a patient. And that really was the guiding light in this process.
I just want to ask you a little bit about yourself. With regard to the kind of transplants that you do, have you started out with particular types of transplant and moved into pancreas, or have you worked on just pancreas as a specialty since you trained?
So I'm a multi-organ transplant surgeon. I do all abdominal transplants, including kidney, liver, pancreas, and small intestine. Pancreas has always been special to me in that David Sutherland, whom I trained with and whom I consider my mentor, is probably the father of pancreas transplantation in the world, and he was recognized for that in 2012 by being awarded the Medawar Prize, which is the equivalent of the Nobel in transplantation. So having worked with him, there was a natural slant towards being interested in pancreas transplantation. I started it from day one. I still do all other types of transplants, but I quickly concentrated my academic work and clinical interests to focus on pancreas, and I became the director of the pancreas transplant program here in about 2008. Since then, I've been leading that program here.
Of course, here at the University of Minnesota, there is a multi-decade history of pioneering work in organ transplantation. A lot of people are probably familiar with some of the work that Dr. Najarian and his team did with kidney transplants. But of course, in the early 70s, when they were improving kidney transplants, this is right around the beginning of pancreas transplants. The 1970s was a time when a lot of this early work with pancreas transplants was being done in David Sutherland's lab. I want to backtrack and talk a little bit about what that was like back then. You've been here and you've seen these developments for a long time, not since the 70s, but for a long time, you know, seeing the field develop. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what it was like to work with some of the surgeons who first developed these techniques and, you know, being a part of the continuous improvement that leads to today in this fairly new form of surgery.
First of all, it's been an absolute honor and privilege in my life to having had the opportunity to work with Dr. Najarian when I first came here. He was doing kidney transplants actively, and then worked with Dr. Sutherland, who was who I consider my mentor and was the head of transplantation here, and taught me, you know, basically everything I know in pancreas transplantation in the early years, which I've since built upon. So being with them, being the stalwarts in these areas has been a special honor and privilege. Having said that, I want to go back to the history a little bit and point out that the era of pancreas transplantation in this institution started before Sutherland. It actually started in 1966. The world's first pancreas transplantation was performed here at the University of Minnesota.
And that was Richard Lillehaien.
Richard Lillehaien and William Kelly. So Rich Lillehaien and Bill Kelly did the first pancreas transplant, started on December 16th, 1966, reperfused the pancreas after midnight, so it officially counts as December 17th, 1966. And they did a series of 14 transplants in the first 3 years after they started that program. Unfortunately, the results were not stellar at that time. There was a lot of challenges, infection and rejection being the two biggest issues. Technically, they figured out how to hook it up, but they could not figure out how to keep it going. And patients had rejection or infection and succumbed to it to the extent that all 14 patients did not meet the one-year mark for patient survival. They all died within the first year due to complications. Therefore, when Dr. Najarian came here in 1967 and observed this over the first couple of years, he found this to be an unacceptably high rate of patient loss and therefore placed a moratorium on pancreas transplantation and said, we've got to go back to the drawing board.
And that was shortly after he joined
about,
in 67.
Yeah, I would say maybe around 69. It took him some time, a couple of years, to kind of study the area and come to an understanding as to where things are.
I think the initial focus at that time was also to improve the protocols for the kidney transplants.
Absolutely.
And that was a lot of the early work in the late 60s, early 70s.
You're absolutely right. When Najarian first came in 67, he had come from San Francisco having done some pioneering work in immunology related to kidney transplantation and was developing a new antibody, which later on came to be known as ALG. And the model for using the drug was kidney transplantation, and therefore all the efforts were being placed towards kidney transplant early on. Having said that, there were sufficient problems with pancreas transplantation that I think it needed that breather, so it was stopped. But just to highlight the history, we are the first center in the world to do pancreas transplants, and we have the largest experience in the world to date in pancreas transplants as well. We have performed over 2,200 transplants in the history. And at one point in the 90s, one out of every 10 transplants being performed in this country in pancreas was performed here at the University of Minnesota. So one could say that we're well known for kidney and maybe heart surgery and heart transplants. But in reality, we in today's world, we haven't reached the level of dominance in any other organ that we have reached with pancreas transplantation.
All the more reason why people ought to know about pancreas transplantation, because I think that, you know, hearts and lungs, you know, especially with the mystique of heart surgery also that happened a lot here in the 50s, you know, that seemed like the really high profile, attention getting, newsworthy coverage. So that's why I think it's so interesting to shift the focus to pancreas, not because it is just less known and also very important, but also because there is this track record and success in this program that just seems to be kind of not as well known.
Absolutely. I think you hit it on the head. And diabetes is a devastating disease. Diabetes does not kill overnight like some other diseases do, but it's a very slow demise of organs and tissues and nerves. Almost every single sinew in your body is affected by diabetes. And that's one of the reasons why this academic department started focusing on it back in the 60s. Going back to the story of how after the first 14 transplants, we put a hold on it. And the discussion then was solid organ transplants are not going to work. There's just too much complications trying to put a pancreas in. We don't know how to control the digestive juices, so they end up with infection. And so we got to figure out a way to do islet transplants, which is just taking out the cells that produce insulin from the pancreas and transplanting them alone as a cellular transplant, thereby not dealing with the digestive juices and bowel and so forth. That's when David Sutherland came back from his surgical training in 1972. He was in West Virginia and came back. I think he spent some time in Vietnam and then returned here to the University of Minnesota, opened a lab wanting to do islet transplantation, and that was the goal. The first couple of years, he did several trials in islet transplants with allo islet, meaning transplanting from one animal to another, and found that the rejection was still a major issue. Infection was not an issue, but the rejection and islet loss was an even bigger issue than pancreases. Those islets just did not survive. Then he tried to transplant islets from an animal onto itself by taking out the pancreas, digesting it into islets, and transplanting it back to the animal. And he found that this worked a little better, and we call that auto islet transplants. So his thinking was we could make the islet survive in its own body, but we can't make it survive in another host. Therefore, he went back to Nigerian and came up with two ideas. One was that we should start a program where we do auto islet transplants, since we know that works in patients with chronic pancreatitis, and be able to transplant their own islets in order to understand what about it makes it work. The lack of immunity is one good thing because it's your own tissue. The other piece, he said, was let's go back to pancreas transplantation and start the program, restart the program, because he had made several improvements in animal experiments to control the digestive juices and be able to control the complication rate. He said, so we can better understand the physiology of islet and pancreas transplantation in order to make islet transplantation work. So the way this program got approved for restarting was really as a vehicle to figure out how to make islet transplants work. So in 1978, Dr. Sutherland started the pancreas transplant program back. And during that time, there was a lot of activity. The first human auto islet transplant was performed in 1977. The first human allo islet transplant, which is islets from one person to another, was also performed around the same time. So they all came back to the fore, all due to Sutherland's presence, energy level, and pioneering work in the lab. When pancreas transplants restarted in 1978, they saw that a lot of the problems from the 60s were gone. They were able to keep these grafts longer. They were able to make patients survive. The rejection rate was still high but was treatable because ALG was now in use and was a very effective treatment against rejection. So patients could keep their grafts. And by the 80s, the pancreas transplant curve started shifting up. The number of pancreas transplants just kept climbing. By the late 80s, we were doing maybe 60 transplants a year here at the University of Minnesota. With one-year graft survival rates, what I mean by graft survival is that the pancreas is still functioning, making insulin and keeping the patient insulin-free, of about 40%. So one-half of all patients were still having functioning pancreases at the end of 1 year. And nobody really died that much anymore, unlike in the 60s when everybody, you know, succumbed to the transplant. So that was a monumental improvement. By today's standards, those results are subpar because we've made several improvements since. But in the 80s, that was a great improvement. And so meanwhile, they were doing islet transplants as well and found that it did not work as well.
And so the thing that was meant to jumpstart the islet research became actually the thing itself.
It became the thing itself, and it became the standard because it worked so well. And then they were able to combine it with kidney transplants, and it worked even better in that setting when you combine it with kidney transplants because the presence of a kidney afforded some protection against rejection for the pancreas. The theories are multifold as to why that happens. It happens with other combinations as well. For example, a heart-lung transplant has decreased rejection rate for the lung than a lung alone. A liver-intestine transplant has decreased rejection rates for the intestine than an intestine alone. So there are some theories why a combination transplant may confer protection to one organ. But the pancreas is a beneficiary of that combination.
What else do you think that people in general should know about pancreas transplantations? What do you want people to know about the work that you do?
I think it's important to understand that pancreas transplantation is a therapy that's longstanding and proven, even though the awareness is low. And it's mostly awareness, not just amongst patients, but even amongst physicians. So I urge people who are in a situation where they have debilitating diabetes or kidney failure associated with diabetes to seek information on it now on pancreas transplantations and talk to a program that does it and understand your options. And maybe 10 years from now, we'll have a different technology. 20 years from now, we'll have more people seeking cell transplants. But here and now today, pancreas transplantation offers the best cure for your condition, and that's something we are eager to disseminate.
Dr. Kandaswamy, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories is a podcast of the University of Minnesota Department of Surgery and is produced by Amanda Brower. Our audio tech is Brian Carnell. I'm medical historian David Korostyshevsky. Join us next time on Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories.